You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, what you got there, Mickey? Oh, it looks almost like Hillary Clinton's reset.
It's a reset button. What is
it?
Yes.
Oh, does it? But it doesn't say reset, does it?
That was easy.
It's actually a Staples easy button, but we're calling it a reset button.
Okay. Let's pretend it said reset on top. Famously, Hillary Clinton brought a reset button to her first meeting with, I don't know, Lavrov or Putin or somebody in hopes of resetting relations with Russia. It didn't work. Apparently, also, the word they used for reset was had some sort of unfortunate translation in Russian.
The word was overcharge.
Yeah.
So it's not...
Well, better than Kennedy in Berlin saying we are all jelly donuts when he meant to say we are all Berliners.
I don't know. Overcharge is maybe not even a crazy metaphor for the Biden Build Back Better plan.
That was easy.
I thought this meant we were going to talk about Ukraine-Russia, but no.
I know. We should talk about Ukraine-Russia. That's topic A. So let's talk about that.
Oh, I don't have any radical insights though, and maybe you have. I mean, we'll get to it for sure,
Okay, well, you want to talk about Biden first? Talk about Biden first.
Sure.
Whatever
There was the press conference. This was a milestone. His second press conference or what?
I think
in
so.
A year?
And he went on for 2 hours, and I think he put a dent in your theory that he's not up to the job. I mean, he stood for 2 hours. I didn't watch it. I read the transcript. He seemed no more incoherent at the end than he was at the beginning. And, you know, he made this huge faux pas, allegedly.
Well, faux pas that starts war doesn't count as not having your shit together in your book?
He's never had a war. He's yet, always committed huge faux pas. I mean, he obviously has he was bloviating exactly the way he always bloviates with his he thinks he has some grand theory that somebody's given him about Russia's trying to find its place between China on the one hand and Europe on the other, and you know, it doesn't seem to really mean much. The faux pas was that he said, well, if Russia only does a minor incursion, there would probably be less sanctions than if they do a major invasion.
We would have more trouble getting our allies to agree on sanctions was kind of the unsignificant sanctions.
And then I take it the ally we would have special trouble with is Germany?
Could be. I mean, they're the ones with the Nord Stream, is it the Nord Stream, whatever pipeline it is, matters to. I mean, here's my take on his cognitive status is one thought I had. I didn't watch that much of it. I just kind of turned it on for a randomly selected 10 minutes to get a sense of things, but it was near the end. And he was clearly proud of his stamina. I don't know what kind of preparation went into this, but I'm not sure it was totally devoid of pharmaceutical intervention. I don't know. He seemed primed and ready to last for at least 2 hours and kind of brag about it. But that aside, one thing I thought was, you know, one thing he has in common with Trump is that if you just read a transcript of what they're saying, you would in both cases say, are you sure English is his native language? But if you're watching them, you know what they mean, okay? That is true of both of them, but there are two differences. One is that if you read a transcript from Trump 20 years ago, I think it reads about the same. I think if you read one from Biden 20 years ago, it would read more coherently. I think he is on a more rapid decline than Trump by long shot. The other thing is the sheer velocity of speech, right? I mean, Trump doesn't have these long pauses where he's trying to find the right word and half the time winds up finding the wrong one. So to me, this all just reinforces the idea that the Democrats need to have a secret meeting and figure out who's going to run in 2024 because it should not be him.
Well, I agree with that, but I will say, Bob, that I have a higher IQ than you do, buddy, I think. And that's what Biden said in New Hampshire in 1988 when he...
Are you really saying it to me just out of curiosity?
No. I'm saying that that's what Biden said when he flew off the handle in 1988 in an incredible performance that forced him to drop out of the presidential race. And, you know, and he came up with five credentials, four of which were bullshit. So he was a bullshitter back then. And also the similar theme of the excesses, you know, calling people who vote against more drop boxes Bull Connor is very similar to his, you know, his subtle invocation of the race card when he was Obama's ready mate, saying they're going to put you all in chains. And it's very similar to what Jimmy Carter did. You know, Carter was a very civil guy, kindly man until he got partisan, and then he turned into a vicious asshole. So my new paradigm for Biden, I was thinking of, and this was suggested by a Twitter commenter, the new paradigm is maybe he's not a kindly old grandpa, maybe he's an asshole. Doesn't quite fit, because he obviously is sort of a kindly old grandpa, but
it's kind of like you, you know, it's like, is it the you we see out here or the you we see in the parrot room? You know, it's like night and day.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it is.
By the way,
thanks.
Which one's better?
What?
Which
well, that's what people have to pay to see, Mickey.
Okay.
And by the way, thanks to those who apparently actually did pony up to go into the parrot room and see me take my COVID test last week. I seem to be okay.
Oh, by the way, because you made the mistake of swabbing your nose and you were supposed to swab your throat.
The next day I did a throat-nose combo. I don't want to get too graphic
here.
Oh, God. I took two subsequent tests that were also negative. Well, that's what they say to do. That's what some people say to do.
I hope you did the throat before the nose.
Well, I did, but if we're going to go all the way here, I just want to say,
Jesus.
The business model, you know, it did work. I mean, I wasn't faking it. I thought maybe I had COVID. I did have some kind of cold or something. So it was authentic. But it did not escape my notice that it seemed to work as a business model, that it got people to go to patreon.com/parrotroom and see me take the test. So what I just think we should stick with it. So, folks, today in the parrot room, on camera, Mickey is going to have a colonoscopy. Is that right, Mickey?
No.
Okay. Next week, folks.
Although my doctor did ask for a Zoom interview appointment in a month, so I don't know exactly what he expects me to show him in a month, but he's interested in other things.
We could do that. We could telecast that live.
No, thanks.
Think about it.
But I do. I also have a reset. I also have a reset for the parrot room, Bob.
You do?
Because, you know, last week I got all defensive about name dropping and tried to not drop names.
Defensive, because after the parrot room we talked, you had all these great stories personages.
The new paradigm is all name dropping.
Totally. That's all we do in the parrot
room. Drop as many
names
as I can. I don't care if people find it obnoxious. The only way to tell stories is to drop the names, and I don't have that many names. Yeah. It's like my mother when I had a debate with Frank Mankiewicz, and I attacked him for using his connections to get ahead as a lobbyist in Washington.
Call him Frank, by the way. Yeah, go ahead.
She said, well, the poor man, his connections are all he has. Of course he's going to sell his connections, right? So the five names I have to drop are all I have, so we're going to drop them.
You've got more names than that.
They're going to be dropping. I'll probably drop names during this thing, too. I should be happy with Biden because the two things I was worried about him doing, he hasn't done, which is enact the child tax credit, refundable child tax credit. I don't mind the non-refundable tax credit. And he basically at the news conference sort of poured a lot of cold water.
Hold on. You don't mind a non-refundable tax credit?
No.
Well, you're fine with it if it doesn't help really poor people?
I'm fine with it if it has a work test that can help low-income working Americans.
Well, that's different.
The work
from
test
the
is very minimal, Bob. It's like you have to have some connection to the labor market. Okay, and it helps a whole lot of helps a whole lot of poor people as it does now, and I'm happy to increase the amount. Yes, it does. It wouldn't help. It would not help a chunk of the poor people.
Stop! I'm just making the point that the distinction between refundable and non-refundable is not the same as the distinction between work test and no work test. Right?
No, that's it's exactly the same.
No, it's not. Refundable. Yes. Oh, so you're saying a non-refundable means that your income has to be at a certain level before you will benefit.
Yeah.
And you're saying the income must come from, will presumably come from work. So there's right. no, in your scenario, there's no actual verification that they're working. They just have to report some income to get the tax credit.
There are some schemes that you have to, you want to, it's okay. easier if you go on last year's work and you have a W-2 or a W-4, you can, IRS can, you know, you can. If the IRS doesn't have your tax forms, you can show them
So I was confused about that. Now, one thing that may bother you, I think you're pretty sure tax credit is dead, so it won't bother you.
But no, I think it might be revived with some sort of work test that satisfies Manchin. It might, then Manchin may cave. You don't know. We don't know.
But here's something that may scare
Biden
you.
Biden certainly seemed pessimistic about it. Let's put it that
way. There was a piece in the Washington Post. Now, this was about a week ago. Things have happened since then. But anyway, a reporter named, Sotomayor, actually, I don't know if she's any relation, but she did a piece where she went and talked to people who are Democrats who are up for re-election and are in these competitive districts, almost entirely districts that went for Trump.
Right.
And she talked to them and she said what these Democratic candidates want from Biden is – to resurrect elements of the Build Back Better. And here's a quote. They're trying to convince him and other leading Democrats, quote, that holding votes on narrow measures such as curbing prescription drug costs and extending the child tax credit would help Democrats make a case that they can improve voters' lives economically. I guess what you would say is as long as they mean non-refundable, you're fine with that.
Yes,
but they probably don't mean that. They probably don't mean.
Well, they probably don't. But the question is, would a non-refundable tax credit help them? And the answer is, it probably would. But keep in mind that the tax credit, the child tax credit, is the one part of the Biden agenda that does not test well. Even Matt Iglesias, an ardent proponent,
this is my reply to that,
and he admits. Well, so one reporter, that isn't even a direct quote. The one reporter talks to a couple of candidates who say it? No, big fucking deal.
No, here's what I'm saying. It's possible that people talking about poll numbers, when you poll people and say it doesn't poll that well, could be right. And yet these people could also be right, which is if you want to win the swing districts, if you want to have any chance of maintaining a majority in Congress, you need the child tax credit. But those are two compatible facts.
Yes, but they're not compatible if it turns out that it's not popular among independents, which I don't think it is.
Well, so, these people beg to differ. They're the ones running for office. I don't think the reporter made this stuff up.
Who are they? How many congresspeople did she talk to?
I can.
And are they actual sitting congresspeople, or are they people who have no chance?
Yeah, they're people. They are people running for re-election. Like Spamberger, and I mean, I don't know if they all said this very thing.
Well,
but
a lot of
middle of
the road people have latched onto this, like James Bennett's brother,
Senator from Colorado,
because it's a nice middle of the road thing that they can do and makes them seem like they're do-gooder Democrats. Yet it seems to pass muster with a lot of relatively conservative people, and it's a nice safe place to be. But that doesn't mean it's number one in the voters' minds. The problem with Biden is, you know, people want him to fight inflation, but it's not clear what you can do to fight inflation. Jimmy Carter tried
Tax
to fight inflation.
Well, you
and you, and you can let in a huge numbers of immigrants to lower wages. You can do that. And tax the rich has an instant effect on inflation.
Well, a deficit spending supposedly has a pretty quick effect on inflation, and this is the opposite of deficit spending. it wipes out deficit spending and can even put you in the black. you know, on a cash flow basis. So, yeah, it's anti, you know, cutting taxes is inflationary. I mean, unless you're a total whack job, you know, supply sider. Cutting I'm not even sure they claim it. They probably do. But cutting taxes is inflationary. Raising taxes is the opposite. I mean, you know, it does that
so
by
having—
So the public
is clamoring for raising taxes, I guess maybe on the rich.
Well, 99% of them would be fine with it, yeah. And now, it has that effect by at the same time, you know, probably slowing the economy. The ideal thing is to come up with these miracle solutions that, you know, tame inflation without slowing the economy. And there are some, as it happens, we're in a period, we're in a moment where there are things like that. If you could magically clear up supply chain problems and so on. And, you know, you mentioned last time that there is real hope that, you know, the Omicron wave, we both think it will be short-lived and we could be in a very different world pretty soon. In fact, I came across a couple of pieces saying that. There was a piece in this Stat News. It's a kind of a scientific publication saying that by the time it crashes, meaning Omicron, the immunological landscape in this country and in much of the world is going to be profoundly altered. Far more people will have some immunity and so on. And then there was a piece in the New York Times op-ed piece making the same point by some eminent doctor guy at Harvard. And also, but also kind of making the point that in a way, the relative lack of lethality of Omicron is a sneak preview of that world. He says, this is a quote, you may have heard that Omicron is less severe than Delta. That looks to be correct. But once the role of immunity in preventing severe illness is accounted for, it is not that big a difference. So we've already been seeing some of the benefits of immunity through a combination of vaccination and infection. And their point is, there will be even more immunity, significantly more, when this thing subsides, and it's already apparently peaking. It's already kind of peaked,
When you're looking for magic solutions to inflation without cratering the economy, first note that the jobless claims rose to perilously close to the 300,000 level, which is the sign that the economy is going down. So it was like 286 or something like that. New jobless
claims. Wait, the sign that the economy's going down?
The sign that the job market is definitely cooling is when I always thought the rule of thumb was if the jobless claims go over 300,000. And they're at 286 now, and so if they only have a little way to go. And so we could be faced with stagflation, which is inflation at a time when the economy is,
well, that's
it's not in recession, it's when the job market is bad. And the traditional... That always makes me reach for the Weizmann plan, which is Harvard economist Martin Weizmann's idea that to attack stagflation by requiring companies to pay workers a large chunk of their pay on the basis of a profit-sharing agreement, not because it encourages GUI labor management cooperation, but because it, in effect, every time they hire somebody, it lowers the wage of everybody else just a little bit. So it encourages firms to go out and hire in a way that's not inflationary. So it's potentially a cure for stagflation. I actually sent a memo to somebody in the Obama administration proposing it, and he said, yeah, it was on the list, but Obama didn't go for it. And one reason people don't go for it is that Weizmann himself has sort of abandoned it. But because he tested it out in Japan and it didn't seem to produce very big results in Japan, but his partner Freeman has not abandoned it, as far as I can see. So anyway, I just throw that out there as a possible stagflation solution. But other, it's a lot better than win buttons. Remember, Jimmy Carter fought inflation
whip
with win
inflation
buttons.
Now, no, that was Gerald Ford, I think.
Oh, that was Ford. Buttons. You're right. No, Bob Strauss had the win button. Yeah, okay, it was Ford.
Whip inflation now. Okay. That did it.
I wonder what a win button.
Remember, Nixon, Republican, imposed wage and price controls. That is amazing.
I wonder what a win button goes for now on eBay. But you're right. And the constant temptation is to impose some sort of controls, which would be bad. Anyway, So Biden may have given up on the child credits, child tax credit, maybe not. And the other thing I was worried about, of course, was immigration amnesty. And even though it would be a potential inflation cure, not worth it, but a potential inflation palliative, I don't think an amnesty is going anywhere. I think Mayorkas is still going to open the spigot and let in as many, immigrants under fake asylum claims as possible, and it'll be numbered in the millions. And I think that's intentional, but I don't think there's a general amnesty. So I should be happy with Biden, but I'm not.
And why aren't you?
I don't know why. Well, I would like, if he doesn't do those two things, I would like him to be an effective Democratic president. I would like him to make the healthcare system better. I would like him to make the economy better. It would be better if he hadn't over-goosed the economy in the stimulus bill and brought us a resurgence of inflation. That was completely unnecessary. And I do think, the Afghanistan thing, which I support, may have international repercussions in that we did it so badly that people think we're incompetent and they can push us around, and Ukraine will be sort of one test of that.
I think the standard reading, I mean, I don't buy any of you, but I think that the standard thing to say along the lines of what you're saying is that the very idea of withdrawing from Afghanistan.
Oh, yeah, I'm not saying that. I'm saying
is
what
hurts
said.
Our credibility. Yeah, so that's a new take. That's a new and
interesting
take. No,
I've seen that take. Should we talk about
is that Ukraine?
Yeah.
Sure. What's your? We haven't. You know, Blinken had a thing today that, so far as I know, didn't produce a breakthrough. He met with Lavrov in Kiev. I guess.
I don't. First, I see on the web all these things about how Trumpists are being irresponsible, and I haven't seen it. As far as I can see, the Trumpists have hewed to their resistance to getting involved, and it's the people like Ben Rhodes who have been, sort of more bellicose. And what I don't understand is, this was written by a conservative on the Washington Examiner named Tom Rogan. Putin may ask for written responses to his demands, okay? We don't even give him the written response. Rogan's point was even giving him a written response would be a sign of respect that he would appreciate, okay? And the second thing is, what's the substance of the response? I don't see why we can't, threatening sanctions, which are not going to work because Russia has huge cash reserves and the Europe needs its oil and gas, so they're not going to crack down on that. Better than sanctions, give him a reasonable concession on NATO. I mean, why can't we promise, for 25 years, Ukraine will not be a part of NATO? We don't, NATO people can veto new members. We're vetoing Ukraine. We're going to support Ukraine, but no, we're not. Why is that such a horrible thing to do? Give him some substantive concession.
It's a politically difficult thing to do because of the blob. I mean, go ahead. Not just saying what?
it's bad because of the people who are oppose it. Well, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I mean, look, I early on in the formation of the resistance 4 or 5 years ago, when it started to include the Bill Kristols and Max Boots of the world, I said, wait, this is a trap. in my blob paranoia and my neocon paranoia, I said, what one thing that's going to happen here is these guys are going to endear themselves to liberals who hate Trump, and then next time a big, foreign policy, militarism issue arises, they're going to be on the side of the militarism, or at least going to be on the hawkish side. And absolutely, if you looked on Twitter, when Biden made that gaffe in the press conference, about saying, well, if it's only a limited incursion or whatever, look at the people who were making a lot of noise and getting a lot of attention by freaking out. The Bill Kristols of the world. Now, that's just a tangent to remind people that sometimes even paranoids have enemies.
But nobody's
the
doing
right
the real neocon position, which is we should send, except for Walter Russell Mead, we should send troops there and actually defend Ukraine against Russia and risk a war. Well, we're stuck in this no-win situation, but we're going to threaten sanctions that we know won't work.
Okay, but
that's the neocon position. It's insane.
Well, first of all, I think they understand there's no way we're sending troops in there. I mean, one virtue of what Biden has said is he signaled that so clearly from the beginning that they're not even going to try. That's a lost cause, assuming they would want that. But the question you asked was, well, why can't Biden just say, okay, NATO's not happening in Ukraine? And I think the answer is all of the domestic political pressure largely generated by the blob, including its neocon resistance wing, which has gotten more influential among liberals by virtue of the resistance, which, again, is kind of a tangent. But the short answer to your question is, I think he fears the domestic political blowback. And, you know, the blowback, they have kind of something to be said for their position, which is, well, should we make big concessions like that in the face of the threat of the use of force or something? And I would say in that case, I don't know, it's pretty easy because, for one thing, there's no way Putin is going to try to take all of Ukraine. And you can just reverse the position. You can make it conditional. You can say, should Russia ever invade Ukraine, then all bets are off. And as far as NATO goes, you could say that. So I don't, I just don't see this winding up as being Munich all over again in any event. But
you would not make this concession, it seems to me. Well, what if we stand firm and the French, force this concession on us? I mean, part of the problem with what Biden says is when I'm negotiating with a rival and I say, why don't you do this? Why don't you have a minor incursion? That's the last thing the rival wants to do. The rival doesn't want to do what you invite them to do. The rival wants to do something that you hate. The danger is that saying minor incursion encourages Putin to do a major incursion. You want him to sort of force you. You want him to do a minor incursion. You want to be really annoyed at the minor incursion. Why can't the French force us against our will to make this NATO concession?
We should have never expanded NATO. Right. And then B, for sure, and a lot of people agree on this, even within the blob, George W. Bush should not, in 2008, against the wishes of Europe, he had to strong arm the Europeans into agreeing, issue this statement. I think it was a NATO statement saying eventually, Ukraine and Georgia will be part of NATO. That has caused a world of trouble.
There's a very good Substack by Adam Tooze that also points to that.
Yeah, no. Oh, that was a big thing. Sure. And one question is, why should Biden be bound by an idiotic promise made by the president who got us into the Iraq war? Why not? If Trump can pull us out of the Iran deal, which was actually working, can't a Democratic president disavow an idiotic promise made by a guy who was clearly a foreign policy disaster, George W. Bush?
Or why can't we do a missiles in Turkey thing where
we're offering
like Kennedy in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we go to Putin and say, look, we're not going to expand NATO. We promise that, but we're just not going to make it public because it would be too embarrassing.
I see. Well,
but yet it does become public, so it becomes known that Putin got this concession from us. We just don't humiliate ourselves in public.
First of all, I guess removing the missiles from Turkey was something we did, and then it was done, and he knew it was done. Promising not to do something, on the other hand, part of Putin's concern also is the inter-administration continuity, which clearly is a problem with American foreign policy, right, as Trump and the Iran deal showed. That's why he wants it on paper. He wants to at least make a next president formally rescind something, even if it's just an executive order. And that's all it could be, because Biden ain't getting Congress on board with anything along these lines.
Why is it in Ukraine's interest to constantly talk of NATO. All it does is piss off Russia and get them invaded. Why can't they be an ally of NATO, not part of NATO? You know, they won't have the automatic NATO protection, but it's better off if the Russians are scared to take over the whole country. That's their protection. So
it's a good question. I mean, one question, and by the way, speaking of missiles, we have signaled a readiness to do deals in that sense, like change where certain American forces are positioned in Europe, make them less close to Russia or whatever.
Well, why don't we do it in writing?
I think we're willing to do that in writing. We haven't done anything in writing. No, but I think we would be willing. I think we would be willing to do that, do something along those lines, or just do it and show them we did it or something. But, you know, as for Ukraine, it's a good point, and it's related to the question of whether there isn't something Biden could say that wouldn't 100% freak out the blob, which I'm not sure he needs to fear anyway. I mean, how much lower can his poll numbers go, right?
Well, how many voters does the blob have? They have like—
Exactly.
They have like 500 people in Manhattan.
That is what
Trump showed us. Another 500 in Washington.
That is what Trump showed us. Actually, they don't give a shit whether you bow down to the grave of John McCain. It wasn't a grave at that point when Trump refused to bow down to it, but— No, I mean, Americans don't care that much about foreign policy. Call the blobs bluff. And your poll numbers can't get lower anyway, and there's no real evidence that the blob commands much force when it comes to poll numbers.
Right, okay.
But they do command a lot of force with elite opinion, and that's the problem.
Do you think they're more important or Tucker? Tucker's a bit on the right side on this, right?
Well, Tucker's talking to people who are already saying they don't like Biden in the polls. I mean, that doesn't help, you know, and who aren't going to vote for Biden in any event, or any Democrats. So anyway, it still looks kind of, I guess, a little bit grim. You know, last time I said the smart money was that he would invade in mid to late February. I've since heard that once you get to late February, the weather becomes unfortunate or something. I mean, I think once certain things
too muddy. Thaw,
no, I think it has to do with things thawing and your stuff getting bogged down or something. Yeah. I may be totally mistaken, but I still think the smart money is he does not have the logistical stuff in place right now to invade like next week.
There are also stories that he in fact has he's forming a shadow government in Kiev, which would imply he's going to go all the way.
Well, I mean, good luck with that. I just looked at a linguistic map of Ukraine, and not a lot of Russian speakers once you get into the West, I'll tell you. In fact, geographically, if you just look like county by county, it looks like there's not that many in the East. It's just that they tend to be the areas of heavy population. So there's kind of like a lot of rural Ukrainian speakers, even in the pretty far East.
Is there any chance it'll actually get bogged down in a guerrilla war where, you know,
well, that's one of our threats.
That's one of our threats. Yeah. But he has to be too smart to do that.
Yeah. I mean, one thought is that what he wants, that one thing he would settle for establishing is a land bridge from Crimea up to like Donetsk, like the parts that are already under de facto kind of Russian speaking control, the stronghold of the rebels. Which would also be a land bridge, I think, to Russia itself. There is no direct land connection to Russia itself. And so he might want to establish a corridor there in the southeast. I don't know.
Anyway, so you think if you were giving Biden a grade on handling it, what would you give it?
Well, the conventional wisdom is he gets credit for keeping the Europeans more or less together so he can credibly threaten sanctions, although he undid a little of that by announcing during a press conference that he hadn't done that, kind of. It really was.
So it was a Kinsley gaffe. He accidentally told the truth.
Oh, he told the truth. Yeah. I think he was telling the truth. He has this impulse, and I suffer from this myself, to kind of want to tell people that you're being candid, you know, like thinking you'll get points for that,
right.
And like welcoming them into your mind to see what you're really thinking. Actually, I have found that's a super bad idea almost always.
The other thing I was thinking was maybe it was reverse psychology. The weirdest thing I thought he said was when he said, well, Putin has to do something. Well, isn't that giving the game away? I mean, and why not structure it so with the something Putin has to do is something we can live with, like getting a NATO concession as opposed to a minor incursion. So I thought it was might have been a little reverse psychology where he said, you know, well, Putin's going to do a minor incursion to discourage him from doing a minor incursion because that's what
so
we
he
wanted to do.
So he could prove Biden wrong.
Anyway, I guess
that's
not
another thing he probably shouldn't have said. He should have thought that. He should put himself in Putin's shoes in order to, you know, formulate a good strategy, but he shouldn't necessarily share all the thinking.
So anyway, you're continuing with Biden's grade. Yeah, we got so he's maintained a united front, but the result is Putin's going to invade Ukraine. He's going to, and the sanctions are not going to work, and we're going to look weak. I mean, maybe that's not the end
of
the world.
We'll see. I heard, you know, Chris Murphy, on NPR, and he's a smart guy who keeps track of foreign policy, suggesting that he knew couldn't quite tell us how he knew this, but he apparently thought that Germany had agreed to actually axe the Nord Stream pipeline if Putin does a full-on invasion, and that fact had been communicated to Russia. That's what he said. Now,
that makes no sense.
True,
Germany just killed its nuclear power, which so it doesn't have the energy to kill the Nord Stream pipeline.
It shut down two of its four reactors, yes.
Which is 6%. Unless they're going to start them up again. I guess they could. That would be an interesting signal if Germany started back up its nuclear reactors, but they seem to be they have no intention of doing that.
That would be smart. We should encourage that.
I mean, so Merkel's made two huge mistakes. There's the immigration.
She's not around anymore. She's not the leader.
But I think she's the one who decided to kill the nuclear power.
It's a residue. Yeah,
She did that, and she did the opening of the borders. So she's not such a genius after all.
I don't know.
Even if they assimilated the migrants who came successfully, which some people claim, it's still a horrible precedent to set. It encourages future waves, and eventually you won't be able to assimilate them.
What's your position on the child tax credit?
Bob, I'm glad you asked me that.
Well, you already got us back to immigration. I figured you could pull off
it was a digression. People love digressions.
Well.
The Dwight Garner principle, they love digressions.
Now, speaking of things. So filibuster reform is completely dead. There's no version of it.
That's what people seem to be saying. And Biden, they asked him at the press conference, what's the next step in voting rights? And he said, executive action. So obviously part of his strategy is going to be, you know, a lot of executive actions on immigration and on the filibuster.
Or you can pass things that you can get 10 Republican senators to support, right? Are there elements of BBB you could do that with? Climate change, anything?
Well, the child tax credit is reputed to be one of them, I think it will have some sort of work requirement because Romney has gotten some religion on that, and Romney is the obvious fulcrum for getting Republican votes. But Romney's only one vote; he needs nine more.
He's gotten your religion on child tax credit or what?
Yes. Well, he endorsed a plan that was for a refundable one without a work credit, without a work test, pushed by this guy, Sam Hammond at the Niskanen Center, in exchange for eliminating welfare and doing a lot of conservative things. And he seemed to be toying with the idea of a sort of guaranteed income approach. No, we don't require work. We just give them the cash. But when he said, you know, recently, why can't we just, you know, negotiate the tax credit separately from reconciliation? He made a point of mentioning the work issue. So that was considered like, well, he's gotten a bit of the work religion.
Now, we should be clear. I think we just made a confusing transition. The filibuster reform has been about the Voting Rights Act, but the reason we started talking about needing 60 votes to get chunks of BBB passed is that the Democrats can still, I guess, with one piece of legislation, right, use that, what's the term for the loophole that they were going to use?
The reconciliation.
Reconciliation, right, and they were going to use that for all of BBB. But if you break it up, you can't use it more than once, right?
Well, they don't know. It's all very vague how many times they can use it. They might be able to use it again, but they can't use it for voting rights because it has to be budgetary.
Right, because it has to be budgetary.
Yeah. So they need 60 votes for the voting rights. They don't need 60 votes for reconciliation, but they can't even get 50 votes because they don't have Manchin and Sinema for a bunch of things on reconciliation. So they had them for the voting rights. So. Anyway, but they might be able to break. Biden's approach was rational in that he might be able to break up BBB and get more than one reconciliation vote. It's all very up in the air. Depends on the parliamentarian. Can we talk a bit about whether Trump is fading or not? I mean, that's a big story. They were like three columnists who said, "Wait, no, Trump doesn't have it locked up." DeSantis, he has this feud with DeSantis. Ann Coulter pointed to some polling numbers where, Trump does worse than you'd expect among the general population. And her theory was sort of the Norma Desmond theory, which is Trump's still big, but the Republican Party got smaller. So he's still big among Republicans, but the independents he's losing. So... and some of them vote in Republican primaries, so you can't necessarily look at his poll numbers among Republicans and say, see, he's still popular. Plus, there was another poll that showed that the number of people who say they support Republican principles versus support Trump is increasing. Their ratio is increasing against Trump. Plus, so it goes to what, and so there was a piece by Kurt Schlichter, who's a pretty hardcore MAGA guy, I think, and Ann Coulter, and also Rich Lowry, saying, no, wait, this isn't over. DeSantis can make a run against Trump. And I think that's true. I mean, plus, as Schlichter, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, said, DeSantis, he runs for re-election. That means if he waits a cycle and lets Trump run this time, he'll be out of power for 2 years before the next presidential race comes around. That doesn't really do him a whole lot. That's not really such a good position to be in. I mean, yes, it worked for Reagan. It worked for George W. Did it work for Bush? I don't know. Sometimes it works to be out of power, but it probably may not work for DeSantis. So why not run this time? This is his shot. He's hot now. No guarantee he's going to be hot in 6 years. So
tell me something. If I knew enough about Ron DeSantis, like more than I do, which means anything to speak of, except that he's kind of a COVID hawk, which unless it's Dove that is the word to use.
Well, he's pro-vax.
The disease, but
he's pro-vax.
He is pro-vax.
Pro-monoclonal antibodies. Perhaps because he's in a
Joe Rogan's pro monoclonal antibodies.
Okay, well there you go.
But he
was offering monoclonal antibodies for free to anybody who needs it. That was his big initiative. So it's
my question is, what would I, knowing what you know about my ideology, what would I think of DeSantis? I mean, presumably, I mean, like on foreign policy in particular, do we know anything?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't think we know, and probably he doesn't know. But my instinct would be that you would think, just looking at him, that you wouldn't like him. But
but
if he wants to be MAGA, he's got to be anti-interventionist. So there you go.
Well, I mean, but didn't we just say that the deal with foreign policy is people just don't care, the masses don't care one way or another, and it could well be that in trying to compete with Trump for funders, he wants to go neocon on foreign
policy. The MAGA people care about foreign policy. Maybe they don't care about the blob.
Which MAGA people? You mean like Tucker Carlson?
I have a friend who works for Reddit and says, you know, the Trump Reddit thread, there were three instances where they turned against Trump, and one of them was when he threatened to intervene in Syria.
But those really are elites, like it. In effect. Those are not the masses. People on Reddit are not the masses. They're unusually well-informed. Those are, in effect, elites speaking.
Okay.
I maintain.
Not elite elites. Okay.
People
don't like it when we, when people start dying.
If we go into a war
and people start dying, they don't like it.
That's bad. That's when people start caring about foreign policy, is when Americans come home dead in significant numbers. What was I going to say? On the independence issue, I mean, in terms of Trump winning the nomination, I would think that there just aren't enough independents voting in primaries for that to matter. I would think what would matter in a way about the independents is if their position became so problematic, if the independent vote became so problematic for Trump that, again, Trumpist elites got concerned that Trump couldn't possibly win the election. That's the way that could hurt him during the nomination drive.
I don't know about I don't know about independents voting in primaries. I also don't know if it's true that Republicans have shrunk and independents have grown. I mean, I think that's sort of been the pattern, but has it happened a lot recently? I don't know. Independents are famously a largely Republican group. Recently, they're sort of so. I think they might try to vote in the primaries if they could. Anyway, I just think there's a shot at not having Trump as the nominee. There's a shot that he won't run if he feels, you know, it might be like Lyndon Johnson and Gene McCarthy. If McCarthy didn't win the New Hampshire primary, but he did well enough to convince Johnson not to run. So it may be that, the combined weight of Trump's opponents in the primary takes such a chunk of the vote that even though Trump wins a plurality, he decides, he conjures up some excuse not to run.
The Lyndon Johnson thing brings us back to Biden and trying to keep him from running for reelection. And I think the only possible path is to convince him. And I don't know who does the convincing or who does the convincing of the person who convinces him, which probably has to involve Jill. But I think the thing you have to convince him of is, like, you will go down in history as a great person who, you know, if it won't matter what your opinion number, your poll ratings were at the end for purposes of the historical evaluation, if you stopped the bleeding on the Trump front, you got Trump out of the White House, and then altruistically stepped aside because you thought that maximized the chances of the party.
You're Harry Truman. The White House. Unpopular, but history will look at you kindly.
But Harry Truman did run for re-election and lose.
Right, but he was, I believe, unpopular when he left office.
He ran in 52, right?
He ran once. Yes.
He defeated Dewey.
Right.
Truman did defeat Dewey. So did he?
That was 48.
Adlai Stevenson ran
against 48. That was 48.
Adlai Stevenson ran in 52?
Yeah. The problem with that theory is by the time when Biden decides he has to run, he's running for re-election, it'll be 2 years out and he will still think he will be popular by the end of his term. Because look at Reagan, look at Clinton, they were both unpopular at the midterms, but they were popular by the end. Obviously, that's what his clique thinks. So, you're not going to be able to make the Truman argument. But your idea is basically right. You have John Meacham convene a meeting of historians at the White House. We have Michael Beschloss and Dorothy Kearns Goodwin, and they say, Joe, the way to cement your place in history is not to run. Then you'll be a statesman. Focus the last 2 years on achieving great things. Without above politics, it's a bunch of bullshit. But he might buy it. He bought their bullshit before about it. He was the next FDR. That's the source of all our problems. There's a unified Meacham theory that Meacham is the man responsible for the failure of the Biden administration. because he promoted this, also maybe for electing him, he promoted this "I'm fighting for the soul of America" bullshit, and then he convened the historian summit where they convinced him he was going to be the next FDR, so he should go for a think big in terms of build back better, which has been a calamity. So I'm just working on that. Meacham's been very nice to me, and I am totally
on board for blaming Meacham for as many things as possible. Speaking of which, I saw there in the Wall Street Journal, there was a reported piece blaming Schumer for the mishandling of Manchin. I'm also in favor of blaming Schumer whenever possible. Did you see that piece?
I did not see the piece.
It seemed kind of off because it was like, I didn't read it all, but I gather the idea was he didn't really turn the screws on Manchin. As I read Manchin, he's got like a chip on his shoulder. You don't turn the screws on him. And you got to show him lavish respect.
He's wildly popular in West Virginia. You can't turn the screws. There are no screws. Obviously Biden's Meacham-esque turn into calling people Bull Connor. How is that going to help him? How is it going to help him get Manchin's vote if he calls him Bull Connor? Makes no sense at all. Maybe he took Manchin aside and said, you know, I'm going to call you Bull Connor and say all sorts of nasty things about you with his voting rights, but I don't really believe it, so don't worry about it. And maybe Manchin buys that, but it can't help.
He said that in the press. What did you think of how he handled it in the press conference? He said they were Bull Connor.
It wasn't
that bad, given that he was.
I thought it was pretty bad. The reporter conceded that he wasn't saying that these people were actually Bull Connor, just they were on the side of Bull Connor, yet he responded with anger as if that's what they'd said. So he didn't listen to the question. He was primed to get angry, and he got angry. And then he took it back. Then he said, of course, history will judge that you were on the side of Bull Connor. So in effect, he compounded the insult in the course of his answer. So I don't think it was very effective. And it's crazy. Arguing that people, just because people don't want drop boxes and want voter ID, doesn't mean they're Bull Connor. We're going to basically have a fair election where the turnout among minorities is going to be a huge record. It's not Bull Connor.
He should have just stopped there. He should have just said exactly what he should have just said. That's crazy to say they're Bull Connor, and then just moved on.
There you go. I think there's some grandiosity in the hermetically sealed White House, and we still don't know what's going on there. There was a big piece by Molly Ball, I think it was in Time, that had no TikTok at all about who made what decision to do what the Biden White House did. She sort of flicked at the fact that they're a little like this, they're running the place, and they united against having anybody else brought in new who's just going to screw up their power running the place. So, but there must be some divisions within that camp. And I can't believe Bruce Reed has gone all for all these crazy things that Biden has done. He's too sensible. So I have no inside information, but maybe he has no power, but I would be interested in what the dynamics are within the Biden White House. And, we have no idea. It's a black box as far as we're concerned.
It's true that we have no idea. By the way, was there more on Kamala this week? Harris team looks to course changes to reset her political prospects, the Washington Post. I think this is since we talked. You'll like this. That's not the only bump that emerged as Harris tries to regain momentum. Simmons, her new communications director, had to apologize last week. You probably know this. Had to apologize last week for years-old tweets in which he asked why immigration officials did not detain, quote, undocumented folks.
Well, that just shows how sick the Democratic Party has become. But the fact that we're talking about the old tweets of the communications director of Colorado, that showed that it was a slow news week last week. I mean,
It was a slow news week.
Kamala Harris is still Kamala Harris. Nothing she do is going to change that. She's always going to be a disaster unless she completely lets Willie Brown take over her campaign. She's going to continue to be a disaster. So I just don't pay any attention to any of that.
What's funny is how this piece, they have a paragraph that starts, aides say it has been difficult for Harris to shake a presidential campaign narrative that she is hard to work for. And then you think this is going to be the paragraph where she quotes the aides, the reporter quotes the aides saying that, but the paragraph continues, several articles criticized her handling of staff amid the departure of high-profile aides in the final days of 2021. Critics scattered over two decades told the Washington Post of an inconsistent and at times degrading boss who burns through seasoned staff members who have found success in other demanding high-profile positions. This was not a good piece for Kamala. But you're right. Slow news week.
Although now it's it'll heat up when Russia invades Ukraine. And the press conference heated it up. But also, it seems to me like a whole lot of people are dying. And is that just because we're boomers and boomers are just going to start dying? And,
a lot of people are dying.
And this is going to be for the rest of our lives until we die. People are going
to
be dying.
It's getting to where the Parrot Room, like a newspaper, has an obituary section. Like, for example, this week, Meatloaf died. That is the
COVID.
Man, not the food, sadly, on both counts.
Of COVID.
What did he die of COVID?
Yes, that's came out in TMZ reported.
Well, he had slimmed down, he had one comorbidity.
He had slimmed down. Yeah, there are various pictures on the web of him looking incredibly dapper. But he was apparently slightly in the Trumpy anti-mandate camp. So we don't know if he was vaxxed or not. At least as of this morning, I didn't know if he was vaxxed or not.
I mean, that makes the difference.
There's a name. For the all name dropping edition, there's a name to drop with Meatloaf.
Oh, you're going to drop a name in the Parrot Room about Meatloaf?
No, I'm dropping a name right now. What?
No, well, you
don't like
the Parrot
Room.
That's what they
the
pay for.
Room. There'll be plenty of names to drop in the Parrot Room.
Mickey.
What journalist is Meatloaf related to? I've asked this before.
Dun, dun,
you forgot.
Dun, 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 dun,
what prominent journalist is actually secretly related to Meatloaf?
Not only have I forgotten what you told me, when you tell me, it's not going to ring a bell. That's how far gone I am.
He's a prominent Washington Monthly journalist.
Dun,
a Charlie
dun,
Peters
dun,
protege.
Dun, dun, dun,
somebody who
dun,
thinks
dun,
I've gone off the reservation.
That doesn't narrow it down. That doesn't narrow it down. Yes. If it's somebody who thinks you've gone crazy.
That
just rules.
A writer for the prestigious, boring, apocalyptic, doomsaying, in decline Atlantic, who has recently started a Substack.
Wait, a Charlie Peters protege, Jim Fallows?
Yeah.
Is related to Meatloaf?
Meatloaf turned up at their family reunions. He's some sort of relation, yeah.
And you've told me this before?
Mm-hmm.
That's the alarming part.
Anyway, so that's one name.
Tell me next week, and then if it doesn't ring a bell next week, then in the Parrot Room, I will do some kind of like cognitive test, and that's what they'll be paying for.
Okay. I think there'll be a different test every week. And the other guy who died was,
but we will talk about Meatloaf in the Parrot Room.
We will?
Either the man or the food. I guarantee one or the other. Who else died?
Andre Leon Talley.
Oh, he's the Vogue editor? Or
yeah, he's... In my book, I had like one... I tried to eliminate any concrete signs of humanity, like actual people that readers might relate to, so I could completely focus on abstractions. And the one residue of concreteness that remained was an article by Andre Leon Talley about, I was trying to just dramatize the Vanity Fair sort of hagiography of rich people, and it was about some woman who said, who had horses and said, oh, the horses are much better dressed than I, which is like a reverse modest boast because only really rich people can have well-dressed horses. Anyway,
sure
he wrote that. Andre Leon Talley
in the
that.
Parrot Room, so in the that. Parrot Room, you can explain what you just said meant because I'm not sure I got that. But I will say, what will I say? Oh, speaking of rich people, do you know, here's an item that, as it happens, is in the Non-Zero newsletter that's going out today. But do you know how the world's 10 richest people have fared during the pandemic, wealth-wise?
Well, they've all gotten richer. We know that.
Yeah, but it double from a total net worth of around $700 million to $1.5 trillion. But most people on the planet have seen their real income decline. These 10 guys, they are white, and they're almost all American.
It's still true that the most damaging part, I think, for society is not the rich getting rich at the top. It's the fact that the entire right. income structure has been pulled apart like a taffy pull. So even within professions like journalism, for example, everybody used to be paid the same. Now the superstars, those that haven't already been fired by CNN, make hundreds of thousands of dollars, and everybody else makes nothing, like $20,000. That's a much more corrosive effect, I think, on society than the fact that Mark Zuckerberg, who was really rich before, is even richer. Who cares?
I got to say, I do think when you look at this list and, you know, all white guys, and during the pandemic, they have doubled their wealth while the real income of most people in the world has gone down. I do understand better why people like you and me, white males, are under a certain amount of fire. It's not the only reason, but I kind of get how you would like look up and go like, you know, things aren't going well in the world. Apparently, these are the guys running it. And what do they have in common? Maybe we need a different ethnic composition in the ruling class.
It's a standard left-wing trope. Am I using this word correctly? To focus on the top 0.1% and make it seem like the income inequality in society is the rest of the 99% against the 0.1%, when it's not. It's the top like 20, 30, 40% that are pulling away from everybody else. That is the fissure in society. And it's not just that we've made it easier for the really rich to get richer. All that is definitely happening. But it's that there are forces in society that we can't control, like the return to skills and automation, that are pulling us apart in ways that aren't easily cured by left-wing cures.
Yeah, you're not arguing with me here. I'm just trying to illuminate the perspective that I think is influential right now. And I'm not. And it seems to me sufficiently kind of natural reaction that you may have to start caring whether all the rich people are white.
What about the fact that there was a sensational murder in Los Angeles of a beautiful white girl from the rich West Side, and all of a sudden people are going berserk in a way that they didn't go when beautiful black girls are murdered? There's a certain amount of resentment about that. On the other hand, people are right to go berserk.
Okay, so what else are we going to talk about in the Parrot Room, I ask you? Do you want some nominees from me?
Sure.
I have the secret to Matt Iglesias' success. We have wondered, how does he produce so much? You think that he has a whole army of bright young people doing the work while he lounges around on his yacht. I think he does it. I now have the answer. It's true that it was an answer given to him by him, but I think it was given behind a paywall. And it turns out, by the way, he has a weird cognitive feature. He has a weird, like, brain, I guess, technically. It's not a pathology. It's strange. He's got a strange thing.
I think his Substack is going downhill. I think he's reaching a point of it's still good, but it's just not as good as it used to be. And, eventually he's going to run out of things to talk about.
We'll have that argument, too. We will not run out of things.
What do I have to talk about? I can talk about what's up with Henry Cuellar, who's being somehow all of a sudden the FBI is descending on him. Why is that happening? My beef with the Salvation Army. I did some investigation. What did that show? Are they too woke? Should I give to the Salvation Army, even though they've gone woke.
I think you mentioned that last week. Have they gone woke? I've always said you can't talk too much about the Salvation Army's wokeness because people never.
How is the parrot room like Yellowstone, Bob? Hit TV series?
I thought you meant the park, but it's a good riddle. I'll try to answer it.
Some bullshit from your favorite institute, the Quincy Institute.
It's not bullshit if it came from Quincy, man.
It is.
By the way, I was on a Quincy-related panel. You want me to drop a name? I'll talk about this more in the parrot room, but I was on a panel, a virtual panel, Zoom panel, but it was like live Zoom panel with a former governor of your state, Mickey.
You're on a panel with Jerry Brown?
I certainly was. Me and Jerry, same plane.
At the Quincy Institute?
It wasn't physical. It was on Zoom, but it was live streamed.
Right.
Me and him and two other people on the panel, and people were like, Bob, Jerry, they're on the same plane, of course.
Has he lost it? He's as old as Biden, isn't he?
I'll tell you, if I'm alive at his age, I think he's in his early 80s. I think he's over 80. I certainly won't be as articulate as he is.
That's my impression. It'd be a good nasty journalistic sort of technique to compare Jerry Brown's mental facilities at his age and Biden's mental facilities and show that you don't have to be like Joe Biden when you're 85.
We know you don't have to be, but some of us may well be. So who are we to throw stones? Okay. I want to say a little more about Robert Malone. I discovered, beyond what I have said in the parrot room about him so far, there's something I discovered. Now, that was in my newsletter last week. On the other hand, it was behind the paywall. And then there's something else I've learned about him that I think helps corroborate my tentative diagnosis of him. What else? I want to talk about active shooter drills, which have gotten a lot of attention in the wake of that synagogue hostage standoff in Fort Worth. I want to talk about the war in the Pacific.
Off, but we don't.
Well, that's the question. That's one question that will come up. War in the Pacific. I'm slogging through this trilogy on the war in the Pacific during World War II.
I want to talk about an interesting figure in American culture who I think should be. I just think the concept is inherently hilarious, which is the Los Gatos party mom, a woman who's in jail for having parties where she encouraged kids, teenagers to have sex. This puts her in jail.
She should get life for that.
Anyway.
That's kind of an unusual thing for a mom to do.
Right, but it seems to be, I mean, I can't believe there's not already a sitcom called Party Mom.
I hadn't heard
Mom.
About this. There's not a good meme about her. We should start one.
I hit upon a disagreement with you about China last week that I think is worthy of expanding into something bigger.
Re-airing? You finally came up with your brilliant riposte?
I had my brilliant riposte. It was not a riposte. It's just a
memory
a
of
difference
that escapes
between
me.
You and me that seems to be worth exploring.
China.
There you go. Well, you'll have to wait for the bear too, Bob.
And then several things commenters corrected me on. One thing you get in the parrot room that you don't get on the regular podcast is I say a lot of shit that's not true, and then they correct me, and I own up to it. That's half the fun.
The continuing decline of the Atlantic and the formation of the basic outlines of if you were going to attack David Remnick, what would you say?
You're going to talk more about that?
Yeah, why not?
Let's make that a series, David Remnick. I won't let you forget that. And then, of course, there's your colonoscopy, but I mentioned that, so they already know about that. That'll be live.
That's already been done anyway.
Yeah, I know. That was Katie Couric?
Correct.
You don't think we could top her ratings? I was interviewed by her once. Should I drop that name in the parrot room? Yeah, I may have already told you this, but that is something to talk about because I also had an encounter while doing that with a now famous Me Too miscreant who lost his job over it. So, wait, there was one more thing. Oh, we'll figure it out.
Name dropping has to be more than just being on a Zoom call with somebody, Bob.
We all do what we can. Not all of us were born in Beverly Hills. Not all of us got tennis lessons from Arthur Ashe when we were kids. I'm just saying,
some people's brushes with greatness are more authentic and textured than others.
We do what we can. Those of us who are born in humble circumstances drop whatever names. Mickey, this is how bad it is. I drop your fucking name. That's how few important people I know. I go around going, well, you know, I call him Mickey. And they're going,
That is pathetic.
Mickey who?
I don't believe it.
It is.
I don't believe it.
I do. I do. And they go, I do it to impress women, mainly. I say, I call him Mickey. And I could probably arrange, you know, a little encounter, if you know what I'm saying.
Maybe a...
Maybe I should save that for the parrot room. This is heading in the general direction of the gutter. So we're going to stop and head over to the parrot room, patreon.com/parrot room. Plus we should plug other stuff that we don't do that enough. I'm Robert Ryder on Twitter. You are you Kaus Mickey or Mickey Kaus? You're Kaus Mickey.
Kaus Mickey on Twitter. And I have a Substack, which
you have a Substack called Kaus Files. Mine's non-zero and smash the like button. And rate and review The Right Show.
That was easy.
God.
That was easy.
Why, folks, if you're why listening isn't on the audio, parrot responding to the easy button?
Why isn't the parrot responding to the easy button?
That was easy.
What can I say?
Wait, you can't get the parrot to recognize the voice, the fake voice?
Yeah, the parrot can only recognize my voice. It's weird.
This is getting
it's like
a little Twilight Zone.
The parrot is imprinted with me.
It's like the parrot is coming to life. There was a Twilight Zone about this, and it didn't end well, Mickey. I don't want to alarm you.
What did the parrot do?
I'll tell you in the parrot room, and I'll see. I will see you there.
Eat its owner? Okay.
I know enough not to give that away for free.
That was easy.
I'll see you in the parrot room.
Okay.
All right.